Thriving, Not Surviving, with your host, Gina Gardner. To lead others, you first need to be the best version of yourself and lead from a place of wholeness. Motivation, empowerment, leadership, personal and spiritual development are just a few of the topics you will hear on Thriving, Not Surviving. So sit back and enjoy the show with your host, Gina Gardner.
Hello there. I'm very pleased to welcome my guest today, Charles McLaughlin. He's got a very interesting career behind him, and I'm really thrilled that he's going to be my guest today. I'd like to read you his bio. Charles McLaughlin is the founder of Future Perfect. Growing people and growing businesses are his passions. He works with leaders to transform their organizations and break through their personal barriers to success. He is convinced that a leader who fails to invest in personal growth will hold back his team and his business. So he now brings his passion to Future Perfect and the growth academies that he runs. But most importantly, he'll help you find joy, freedom, and reward in your working life. Since 2002, he's been living a portfolio executive work style, directing, supporting a number of other businesses as a part-time member of the management team, and now offers this opportunity to others through the Portfolio Executive Growth Academy. He brings over 30 years' experience of developing and growing businesses, startups to global organizations. For example, he worked to grow an international IT services consultancy for Anderson, now Deloitte, a partner in 2001. He built two companies from scratch and supported two others into the Tech Fast Track 100, and now offers this insight to others through the CEO Growth Academies that he runs. Now,
thank you, Gina.
You're very welcome. I find it really interesting that we live in a time where, you know, the idea that a job was going to be for life and that you would do one thing the whole of your life has become a bit of an anathema. That for many people now, they're going to have to focus on doing a range of different things throughout their career, and you're just the man to help them. But before we go into that, it would be really helpful to have a bit about your journey.
Yes, I've had plenty of time to reflect on this as I work with other people. And what I've begun to realise is that they are, as I look back through my working life, there are three themes which come through again and again. The first thing is I've always been passionate about business, about building businesses, growing businesses, really leveraging the potential of businesses. In fact, my mother tells a story of when I was 5 years old and traveling across the US in a train, I discovered that you could get people to buy bits of paper, if you call them tickets, and so I've got some paper and cut it up and went round up and down the train selling these tickets. And then I noticed that the conductor would check whether someone had got a ticket. If they hadn't, they had to buy another one. So I discovered that you can sell the same thing twice.
Nice.
But that love of business has always been there for me. So when I came up to university, I arrived in Cambridge just as the whole microcomputer revolution was taking off, and there was a whole range of startup businesses in the Cambridge area, all devoted to making personal microcomputers available to the everyday person, whether it was the Sinclair ZX81 or the Acorn Archimedes. I thought that if I was going to do a degree, then it should be around computer science, because that would give me a skill that would be fit for the 21st century. So for many years, I was building businesses in the IT world. But about 15 years ago, I realized that there was something else going on. And both my parents, all four grandparents, all of my parents' brothers and sisters at some points in their lives have been teachers. So I say I've been infected. I can't help but teach people. And although I've avoided it and never become a professional teacher, I have, when I look back through my life, always wanted to grow and develop people. So when I completed my undergraduate course, I stayed on as a tutor for new undergraduates. In almost every organization I've been part of, I've written and developed courses. And so when I came to be asked to run a executive coaching and leadership development business about 10 years ago, I realized that this was an opportunity for me to bring all of my desires to run my own business, but also this part of me that wanted to teach together into a new offering. And so I've been bringing that opportunity to grow and develop other people through teaching while running my own businesses, while helping other people to build their businesses. And because so many businesses in this world are technology enabled, alongside that, bringing my understanding of IT into 2020. And so today, I can look back on a working life where at every stage, I've taken control of my own working life. There have been very few times when I have applied for a job that was not invited to apply for. Most of my working life, I have been running my own businesses or being self-employed. And even when I joined Anderson, I was brought in through an executive search business. So in a sense, they invited me to apply for that job. And I believe passionately that we need to take control of our own working lives, not expect somebody to give us a job, or even that your average recruitment agency is going to discover you like a needle in a haystack through all of the online forums. And I see so many people who are disappointed in their working lives. I want them to find something where they can thrive.
You know, it's really interesting that you talk about the fact that you have taken control of your professional life. And it's very much a theme that that underpins the work I do with individuals, with whole organisations and so on. But what about those people who are unhappy around their working life, that don't feel that fulfills them, that satisfies them? But they don't know how to take that first step. They haven't been invited, if you like, and they are nervous about stepping out of the frying pan into the fire. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say to them, it's all about planning and preparation.
Okay.
So even if you've got a full-time permanent salaried role, the reality is it's probably not full-time or permanent, or even fully salaried. I meet lots of professionals who their working lives are more than full-time. You know, they're expected to work overtime. They're not fully salaried because actually that overtime they're going to get paid for, and increasingly a significant proportion of their pay is based upon discretionary bonuses. And finally, it's not permanent because the next time there's a reorganization, they could easily be shown the door. So recognize that's your reality, and then plan for a different reality, a reality where you are making the choices about how you work and when and with whom. And often you need to go back to fundamentals. You need to go back to deeply understanding what your real strengths are. And there's some fantastic tools out there to help you find those strengths. But you also, I think, need to start thinking about what is your working life for? I come across people who sort of bought into a myth that if you work really hard and keep your options open, then by the time you're in your mid-50s, you'll have accumulated enough stuff that you probably be able to retire, perhaps in your mid-50s, your early 60s, and then have the life that you really wanted to have all that time. And the truth is that's a lie. There are very, very few people who I meet who are in their mid-50s who can afford to retire or even want to retire. people recognize that 45 is probably half time in your working life. You know, you've done 25 years since you left university, and you probably want to do something rewarding and stimulating and enjoyable and productive into your late 60s, early 70s. So you need to be thinking about what that second half looks like. And is it about accumulating more stuff? Is it about sacrificing opportunities for other things in your life, like getting married, like having a family, like spending time with your children, like traveling, for this grind and the promise of some future date when you'll be so wealthy that you can do what you like? Because for most of us, that never comes. And even if we get there, we probably don't know what to do with ourselves when we get there. So I would suggest you need to do a fundamental review about what's important to you.
Okay. Do you have particular strategies that would help people do that?
I think it's about broadening your range of experiences. So we run a free program, which we call the Eight Essentials, eightessentials.biz. And that asks a series of questions. And the kinds of things it looks at are, what financial needs do you really have?
Yeah.
What dreams do you have? Perhaps dreams that you've had in the past that you've allowed to die. What gives you joy in your working life? How would you find freedom so that you can do the things you really want to do rather than feel enslaved by an employer or by a job? And where do you want to make a difference? What's your own sense of purpose? What's your own sense of how you can contribute to the community you're part of? And you can sit down and work through something like that. Or you can go and try it out. For other people, it's about trying it out. Maybe, you know, in the UK, we have these people who are called school governors. And it's a great place to volunteer and get new experiences. Or maybe it's through your church. Or maybe it's going out and working for some other voluntary organization. That's a great way of extending your circle, developing new skills, finding out where your passions are, finding out what really excites you. Well, maybe there's that hobby that could become the future of your working life. So can you turn your passion for baking cakes and decorating them into a business? For some people, they can. I had a colleague who I worked with at Anderson. When Anderson was shut down through the Enron scandal, she went off with her partner and started to breed rare pigs in Yorkshire, and ran a very successful pig meat business, had a wonderful time, and had a whole new lifestyle and work style. But given the nature of the individual, she was still keen to be successful and competitive and have the best pigs and the best sausages. But she created a completely new life for herself. Before that, she'd been an IT project manager. So there is life after the corporate.
Okay. So let's say I come and I work with you, that I've been working within a corporate environment and I want something different. And I've recognised my skill set and I've identified perhaps a passion in terms of, let's say, helping people. How does working with you, what is it that you are able to offer people to help them in their journey?
I think probably the most important thing I can offer them is hope. I think so many people have got to a stage in their lives where they're just ground down by circumstances. It seems to be harder and harder to maintain a relationship, harder and harder to bring up children, harder and harder to succeed at work. And actually year in, year out, you know, things seem to get more expensive. People can so easily lose hope. So for me, the first thing is actually enabling them to discover a new hope for their lives, because that's going to give them the capability to persist through the difficulties of framing this new life, because it's not obvious, it's not easy, there's no magic bullet.
Yeah.
But without hope, you won't even get started.
It acts as the rocket fuel, doesn't it, to actually help people?
It does. And, you know, I don't want to work with people that I can't believe in. So if I can't believe in you, I'm afraid I won't work with you. If I can believe in you, I will become a fan and an advocate of you in every situation. I'll be the champion for your future, because I will believe in you. I will see things in you that perhaps you don't even recognize yourself, or you sort of know are true but can't quite believe it. And what is extraordinary to me is how so many of the people who come to me and who I work with haven't really worked out the essential them, that part of them which is so special that everybody else wants more and more of it. But once they start to notice that, once they start to discover that, once they start to be able to articulate to themselves and to others, then they become incredibly valuable. And they become able to do the thing that is most them. But beyond that, there's lots and lots of practical things. And whether it's working out what kind of business structure you want to use, how you're going to find your clients, how you're going to communicate with your market, how you're going to retain clients, what actually the activities are that you're going to do, all of those things, those immensely practical things matter as well. And now I've been working with people in early stage businesses, larger business, big corporates, for more than 30 years. I've seen quite a lot of different ways that you can do things. And some things will work for you and some of them won't. But there are some really simple rules of thumb that I think apply in many, many situations.
Okay. I'd like you just to, for a moment, go back to this business of belief, because I think it's so fundamental. If you don't believe in yourself, then expecting other people to believe in you is actually quite difficult. And there's an exercise that I've done with many clients that they found really helpful in terms of recognizing the essence of them if they're starting from a place where they don't know. And that's to ask between 5 and 10 people, ideally people who in a different range of circumstances, so maybe a family member, a couple of friends, people you work with now, people you've worked with in the past, and perhaps people that you socialize with, and ask them if they would write down, it's important that it's written, what they think is the essence of you. You know, what makes you uniquely Charles and me uniquely Gina? And a number of things happen. I ask them to do the same for themselves and then to actually gather them together and to look at them. And very often, in fact, pretty well without exception, people are hugely heartened by what people say about them. And it gives them an insight of how other people view them, because very often they have no idea. But also through those insights, there's often common themes. And themes, if a large proportion of the 10 people tell you the same thing, then it's much easier to start believing it. And out of that, people have then seen themselves in a completely different light.
I think that's so true, Gina. And I think the other thing is that we're in a world where so many people think that their identity is defined by the qualifications and the skills they have got.
Or their bank balance.
Over again, what I see is what people really value is the experience and the character that you bring. And those things are often invisible on a CV. They're often invisible in a job profile. They're often invisible, actually, in a conventional LinkedIn profile. And because they're invisible, then people don't value them.
But you see, I think that when they meet them, when they see them, they recognize the value. But I think things have become so structured in such a way that we lose sight of people. And I often work with folk who are wanting to look at their CV, and that I have to say, time and time again, they may have got lots of advice from expensive organizations who write their CV, and the first thing I say is, but where are you? Yeah. Don't feature in this. Yeah. And if you don't feature in it, then nobody's going to want to see anymore. The person you are has to jump out of that first paragraph, otherwise you've got no chance.
And it's interesting. The other aspect of this really is it's about learning to be a storyteller.
Yeah, I would agree.
You were kind enough to give me an opportunity to tell my story at the beginning of this conversation. And I've actually spent quite a lot of time honing that story, trying it out on different people, really trying to bring it to life so that it may or may not resonate with other people, but it's my story.
Yes.
And one of the exercises I've done with people is to help people to build a narrative of their life so far. So that it becomes absolutely obvious to them and to the people they want to work with that what they're going to do next is a natural progression. So I was working with a guy the other day, and he had had quite a fragmented career. He'd been doing a bit of this, a bit of that. It looked a bit all over the place, to be honest. But what we saw very quickly as we started to build the narrative was, again and again, he'd come into organizations, he'd found them floundering. He had drawn things together, he'd set them up for success, and then he'd moved on. He may not have been there when they experienced that full success, but he then moved on. And so we were able to tell this story about who he was and how he showed up and what happened when he was around. Now, a CV wouldn't really show that, but by telling that story and actually using the structure of a CV to tell that story, he then became very attractive.
And I think these days, when often many people are applying for a job, it's those sort of CVs where the person stands out, where the story is evident, that that person will be seen in a very different way, because they're a person, they're real, it's not two-dimensional. It becomes three-dimensional, doesn't it?
It does. But I suppose where I've got to is I want to encourage people to manage their life where their work style doesn't require a CV.
Yes.
They're going out and meeting people and saying to them, I'm an expert on the problems you face.
Yeah.
And those people believe you're an expert on their problem. And because they believe you're an expert on their problem, then they believe that you're an expert on the solution. And they will see your value from your understanding and your insight into where they are at. They will not actually be interested so much in what you've done or even what you could do. What will connect with them is you really understand where they are, what their problems are, and you have the confidence to say, actually, I've seen this so many times before.
Yes.
And that means that you'll never have to send a CV again. It's so distressing to me to see people in their mid-40s who applying for job after job after job, and each time computer says no.
I mean, so much now is done by computer, isn't it? So what would your suggestion be to someone who's in that place, who's done the work, who has perhaps worked with you and got their story and got it honed to a place where they are comfortable with it and it really highlights what they can offer and how they can help organisations find a solution? So what are the sort of things that, that you are able to share with people to help them move from where they are now to where you're describing, which is to be an attractive resource that people want to engage with?
Well, for me, it's about being intentional in building relationships with people so that people become more aware of what you offer.
Right.
Now, classically, this was called networking. I'm not sure networking is the right answer anymore. I think there's something more sophisticated and interesting than just networking. But making sure that you're building a rich set of relationships with people where they trust you, where they know what you stand for, where they believe you've got something to offer, and where through them you get recommendations and introductions. And sometimes you will do that through face-to-face meetings, through being part of associations and clubs. Sometimes you'll use social media to do that, but ultimately what I suggest people should do is seek to have regular 30-minute conversations with people, and then from that see whether you can set up a longer face-to-face meeting. And for me, that has created all sorts of opportunities. And what I choose to do is to focus on them as being the most interesting person in the room, very, very actively listen to what they're saying, add my own experiences of the kinds of situations that they're facing, and then draw on that to see whether actually they believe there's something I can do for them. If they believe there's something I can do for them, and I believe I can do something for them, then something will start to happen.
Yes.
And if I don't believe I can do something for them, I've learned, and it's taken me many, many years to learn, don't be a desperate date, as they say. You know, if you have a whiff of desperation, then that's the biggest turnoff to getting work with people. If you are really relaxed about whether you get this particular assignment or not, then actually you become more attractive.
There's a huge amount of wealth in that last part of the conversation. There has been in the previous part of the interview. But I think that focusing on the other person, making them feel comfortable, listening, and actually making it about them is really sound advice, particularly if you happen to be a little nervous. But making that focus on them, it works so much better at every level, doesn't it?
Yes. And, you know, if I think about myself, when I started my working life, you know, most of what I was doing was sitting in front of a screen. And actually, I was quite shy. And if I went into a room full of crowded people, then the tip that I was told was go and find somebody else who's looking even more awkward than you and talk to them.
Yes.
And take a real interest in them. And that will be the way you get started. Now, I feel pretty confident in most social situations, but it's taken me a long time to get there. And I've had to have some quite bruising experiences along the way. But if you are persistent, if you are determined, if you're just plain awkward, then it'll work out in the end.
I think, you know, hopefully that by people listening to people such as yourself and recognising that the advice, if you focus on other people and making them feel comfortable, you will feel more comfortable. And if you are feeling, you know, worried about it, you know, fake it till you make it, because ultimately the more you practice it, the more it will happen. But I also think that the advice in terms of the end of the process that you were talking about is, you know, looking for what are the issues facing that person and how your experience can actually add value without looking desperate is really, really sound advice. So where can people find you and how can people work with you, Charles?
Well, probably the easiest way to find me is to look at portfolioexecutive.biz, which is a website we put up to encourage people to go on that portfolio executive journey. But I'm also out there on LinkedIn. So my LinkedIn ID is Charles McLaughlin, all one word. But actually, I've tried to make a principle that anybody who's prepared to have a 30-minute conversation with me, I'm prepared to have that 30-minute conversation with them. Because I've found over the years that that has created so many opportunities for me. So if when you look at portfolioexecutive.biz, or if you look at Charles McLaughlin on LinkedIn, and you feel you'd like to have a chat, then send me a message and I will set up a call and we can spend 30 minutes just exploring whether there's something about you that perhaps you haven't quite discovered that is going to create a different kind of future for you. And if, when we discover that together, you feel that I can help you to make more of that, we'll take the conversation to the next level. If not, I would have met an interesting and stimulating person and would have had a great chat, and I've learned something more about the world of work.
That sounds absolutely brilliant. And we will put the details in the show notes so that if people haven't quite caught it, that they can know exactly where to find you. So thank you very much for joining me today. It's been really interesting. And I know, particularly in these turbulent times, that there are many people who want a different professional life to the one that they have now. And you're somebody who can really help them discover that and help them navigate their way through. So thank you very much.
I'm very excited to be part of what you're doing. And I know that you're going to bring a fantastic workshop to our group in the near future. So, yeah, delighted to be part of what you're doing.
It's been brilliant. Thank you so much. And thank you very much for joining us. I'll see you after the break. Take care now.
If you're a businesswoman who is overwhelmed or suffering from imposter syndrome, who is tired of having one disastrous relationship after another, or who finds it hard just to say no, well, it's time to take care of you. You get the best out of life by contacting Gina Gardner, relationship coach and best-selling author and motivational speaker. Just visit genuinely-you.com, or you can email Gina directly at gina@genuinely-you.com. Take action now. Start to thrive rather than simply survive. Imagine being a highly successful, enlightened leader who is in complete alignment with your best self, who makes a positive difference on a daily basis. Let me introduce Gina Gardner, an expert in developing transformational leadership with over 30 years of experience. Gina has developed a unique and unrivaled approach to help you step into your genuine power to become an enlightened leader. And when you do, amazing things happen. Go to enlightenedleadership.co or email Gina at gina@genuinely-you.com.
Hello there, and welcome back to the second half of the show. As normal, I'm joined by Rachel Davidson, my good friend. Both of us are number one international best-selling authors, and we'll tell you a bit about that towards the end of the show. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking today about abuse, and it's one of those things that often is hidden, isn't it? Mm. That those people who are being abused are often frightened to tell other people. Although I do believe that the tide has shifted with the Me Too campaign and so on.
Yes.
But abuse comes in a whole range of different forms. Mm. Physical and sexual abuse are probably the ones that people think of when they talk about abuse.
Yes.
But I also think that their emotional abuse is incredibly damaging. Mm-hmm. And, you know, abusing the system, there are so many forms of abuse.
Yep.
But today I want to talk about the aftermath of abuse and how people can recover. Mm-hmm. Now, I need to make it really clear before we start, I am not making light of abuse in any way.
No.
It is incredibly challenging. Mm. It's something that can colour someone's whole life.
Yep.
And
very understandable reasons.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The sadness for me is how often the cycle of abuse continues generation after generation.
Yes, it's a well-known fact, isn't it, that often abusers have been abused. And so
the research demonstrates that that's the case. Now, I'm also not saying that if you've been abused...
No, it's not a mandatory.
No, it's not a given.
No.
But for me... And I've worked with many people who have been abused in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. The important thing is that if you have been on the receiving end of the abuse, that it doesn't have to define your present and your future unless you choose to let it. Now, that can sound really harsh, but ultimately, if you've been listening to these shows, you will know that it is my belief that everything we do is a choice.
Yes.
And every choice has consequences.
Yes.
And not choosing, actively choosing, is also a choice.
Yes.
It's quite interesting how many people stay in an abusive relationship, even though it's really dreadful.
Yes.
But I think they stay there because it's what they know. And that the future and managing on their own outside that abusive relationship, or fear of what the abuser will do if they leave, will keep people stuck. You know, this saying, better the devil you know than the devil you don't, I think is really pertinent here.
And let's face it, there's a lot of abusive relationships that are sort of, you know, they continue because the person being abused just can't see how they can go and create a life.
No.
And also there is an element. I was reading about the O.J. Simpson case, which is years and years old now, of course. But there was an element of that, I believe, in that the victim, she didn't want to give up the lifestyle she had.
That's very
that was
true.
Part of the court case, I think. Slightly used against her, I believe, which seems to my viewpoint a bit unfair, but there is that element of there are it's amazing what some people will put up with in order to keep what things that they perceive to be comfortable or nice. Or
I think it comes to something deeper than that.
Yeah.
And I believe that very often, well, I think we need to make a distinction between children who are being abused, who have neither the
very little power,
the power, the resilience, the understanding that there is an option outside what's going on, particularly if the perpetrator is someone who is threatening that they will harm them or their family, or that they'll be separated from their family, which is really, really common. And I've worked with people who've been abused from the age of 3. And, you know, it's incredibly difficult when you are a child or a teenager to see any option outside that. So I think we need to make that distinction between people who are staying in abusive relationships as an adult, but actually very often in my experience of working with people, that their sense of self, their confidence in who they are, their self-worth is non-existent. And so if you have a very poor self-worth, and you have the trappings of a life which are comfortable and look successful, I think it's more likely that you will feel the need to stay there, because how will I manage on my own?
Yeah.
Financially, I have no freedom. What can I do?
Yeah.
What will people think of me if I am on my own and my the trappings of status disappear too.
Yeah.
So it becomes very complex. And I hope anybody who's listening to this, please do not think that this is in any way judgmental. What we are trying to do is to help you. What we are trying to do is to help you recognize that there are choices. There are always choices, although those choices may be incredibly difficult. So I want to separate this out in terms of those who are abused when they're young and are dealing with that abuse as adults and having to manage the outfall. And those who are, as an adult, in a relationship, whether that's personal or professional, where they're being bullied, abused physically or emotionally.
Yeah, because, the way you frame that leads on to the thoughts around, you know, abuse is actually also a subjective term, and what some people will accept as normal in a relationship, others would consider to be, you know, dire abuse of coercion and so on and so forth. So it is a really difficult thing to unpick, and it really comes down to, you know, if you're calling it abuse in your head, and then justifying staying with it because of some, you know, comfort factor, let's say, then you would if in describing that to somebody else, they would probably be saying to you, well, you know, that's a bit silly. You shouldn't be staying in what you define as abusive. Yes. for this. If you don't call it abuse in your head, then is it really abuse? Even if somebody else looking on the outside says, they do what to you?
I think that's a really good question. I was having a conversation with a client this week who has just finally walked away from a relationship with a guy who was narcissistic.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was controlling.
Yeah.
Who spent his whole life telling her that she was worthless.
Hmm.
Now, incidentally, she was the survivor of childhood abuse too.
Yeah.
And so a big part of our work is about helping her recognize that actually she has value.
Mm-hmm.
And that putting up with somebody behaving in such an unkind and controlling way, telling her that she's worthless, that's something that is unacceptable and that she doesn't have to put up with it.
Yeah.
And that she will survive well without that.
Yes.
So that's at one level. At another level, it is around doing that. And then, I mean, not immediately, but working towards being in a position where you can forgive.
Yeah.
Because when you don't forgive and you hold on to the bitterness, and I have to say she's at the moment going through the stage of being very angry, quite rightly,
yeah,
and very bitter about it, that actually the abuse is still continuing.
Mm.
But actually now it's not because he's there doing it, but ultimately she's holding on to the fact that he has done it.
Mm.
Now, really important, and those of you that have listened to this show will know that we've talked about forgiveness a lot. Mm. But for those who are new to it, my view is forgiveness is not about condoning the act, whatever that act may be. Absolutely not. Nor is it about forgetting it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about burying it. When we bury stuff, it really doesn't work because ultimately it tends to come up all the stronger and bite us.
Mm-hmm.
But it is about recognizing that holding on to that hurt and that bitterness is just as if I'm going to give you the poison.
Okay. Do I have to take it, Gina?
Well, actually, it's not like that. I'm drinking the poison, but I'm expecting
you to die. Meh.
Ultimately, the you holding on to all that hurt does nothing to the perpetrator.
No.
They're oblivious.
Yeah.
But you're carrying that load. And when you let go of that cord to the past, it's like, well, imagine that you were carrying a heavy portmanteau around with you. It was strapped to your feet.
Mm.
And wherever you walked, you had to carry that heavy load.
Mm.
What you're doing is you're cutting the ties to that heavy load.
Mm.
And it gives you the freedom to choose the quality of your present and your future.
Yeah.
Now, for some people, it may feel a very strange concept.
Yeah.
You know, why would I forget somebody who's hurt me this much?
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you're giving yourself the gift. And if you need help, then get in touch.
Mm.
Because it's probably the biggest gift that you can give yourself.
But what about revenge?
Well, I think revenge is highly overrated. In the moment, you may get huge satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
However, if your values, if you're somebody for whom being reasonable, being kind, being compassionate is who you are,
yeah,
then acts of revenge are working against your values.
Yes. I mean, people will often quote the Bible in this matter and sort of say, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth.
Lots of blind, teethless people. Mm. Or toothless people.
I don't read that particular passage in that sort of sense.
Okay.
Of, you know, if you take my eye, I'm allowed to take yours.
Yeah.
I read it as in sort of the laws of karma, in the sense that, you know, if what you put out into the world is negative,
then you'll receive negative back.
Well, I have to be careful here because I don't like to imply that the laws of karma are about punishment necessarily, because I don't believe they are. But there is a cause and effect to it.
Yeah.
There is a sort of a balance and an account going on, isn't there? And so an eye for an eye in that sense means that you know, what you put out will return at some point. So I think the whole topic of revenge, whilst totally normal within all of us, I think the big question about revenge is how do you know that you're because most people say I'm inflicting justice upon this person, and you know, to justify that revenge. And but how do you know that that is justice? How do you know that you're not just repeating the same mistakes constantly over and over again, and so the abuser becomes the abused?
I think there's a huge danger of
that. Yeah, I really think there is.
And for me, ultimately, we have the only person we are totally responsible for is us.
Hmm.
And if we act in an abusive way, even if we've had a really good reason, so far as we think, then my view is that what you are doing is you are repeating the very behaviours that you are finding so difficult.
Yes.
Somewhere along the line, somebody has to say, enough.
Yeah. But someone's got to teach them a lesson.
That's a view. And ultimately, I believe that life will teach them a lesson, whether it's not this lifetime, then in future lifetimes, if that's your belief. But I don't think it's for us to mete out that sort of justice, because in doing so, I think we diminish some of ourselves.
I think you're right. I think that we have to be careful not to simply repeat the crimes that have gone before, but dressing it up as justice.
And the trouble with that is that they get bigger. You know, you've hurt me, so I'll hurt you more.
Yes.
And so the cycle gets worse.
Yes, this is how you know, ongoing political war and conflicts is continually perpetuated.
Absolutely. And I believe that if we have a future as human beings, if we are going to live on this planet and actually have any chance of longevity as a race, then learning forgiveness, and I'm not suggesting it's easy, but it is absolutely possible. Learning to come from a place of love is far, far more likely to help us achieve an opportunity for the human race to survive in the long term.
And of course, the first thing to consider when you say come from a place of love is actually love for yourself.
Absolutely.
For yourself.
It has to start with you, doesn't it? And the relationship that you have with yourself is something that, you know, I think many people neglect.
I agree.
They believe what people tell them. You know, because I was talking, go back to the client I was working with this week, because her partner had said she was worthless, doesn't make it true.
No.
It may be his truth.
Yeah.
But it's not the truth.
No.
And so working on feeling good about yourself, having the confidence to say to people, actually, I don't deserve that, and I'm not going to put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, I think, and, you know, remember that my background is, you know, 21 years at the principal of a school.
Mm-hmm.
Bullies look for those that are easy to bully.
Mm. Yes.
Children and grown-ups are just big children.
Yeah.
Children who have good self-confidence don't get bullied.
No.
They give out an energy, an aura, if you like, which says, you don't, just don't bother.
Yeah, I won't put up with that. Yeah.
And when somebody is nasty, they're much more likely to just smile and walk away, leaving the bully with no power. And I think, you know, if we could give our children the best possible gift in life, that's the gift of self-confidence. Not arrogance,
no.
But the confidence that actually they are enough, they're not broken,
yeah.
And that, you know, that failure is an opportunity to learn and to grow.
Yeah.
So if you're in an abusive relationship, I would suggest please get some help and give yourself the gift of walking away and then of forgiveness, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's now spend a bit of time on those children who have been abused. You know, if you're a child and you're listening to this, please talk to a grown-up, somebody that you trust, somebody at school, a parent, a neighbour, somebody who you believe you know well and that you trust, and let them know what's going on. If you've been the victim of childhood abuse, I would really urge you to get some help, and don't let that abuse define who you are, your present and your future. Again, get some help. And it doesn't have to take years and years and years. I was working with a different client, a guy this time who'd been abused by his parents emotionally. And he was angry. His own relationship was in huge jeopardy. We've had three sessions. And in three sessions, his perspective of his childhood has shifted. And his capacity to forgive has become so much greater. He's happier. And in only three sessions, he's already seeing the difference in his relationship with his partner and his children.
Yes.
And I would urge you, you know, if your boiler's not working, you get somebody in to fix it.
Yep.
If you are struggling with the outcome of abuse, whether that's childhood or adult abuse, please get some help, because it will make a huge difference to you. And if you have children, it'll make a huge difference for your children. Interestingly, how many of my clients, it's because they want to help their children that they're prepared to do the work themselves.
Because they
don't want their children to be coloured by that.
Yeah.
So we've run out of time. There's lots and lots of help for you on my website, genuinely-you.com, genuinely-you.com. My latest number one best-selling book, Thriving Not Surviving, again, has got lots of advice, and you can find that. And Rachel's books, The Point of Me and The Truth of Her, on Amazon. You'll find all of my books on Amazon too. If you're in a leadership position and you're struggling to manage staff, then think about the Enlightened Leadership Program, and you'll find that in enlightenedleadership.com. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Bye now.